In the hysteria of 1692, Salem hunted witches. But one man hunted something else, power. At just 25, Sheriff George Corwin arrested the innocent, confiscated their property, and watched them hang. He tortured Giles Corey to death beneath stones, seized the land of the accused, and profited from every rope he helped tighten. But his reign ended in silence. A sudden death. A rumored curse. Today, his home is haunted. His legacy buried under fear, greed, and superstition. This is the true story of the man who enforced the Salem witch trials and became legend for the weight of the lives he crushed. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, Bloodlines and Badges. Salem, Massachusetts. Winter lingers in the air. The year is 1692. Before the accusations, before the gallows, before the stones, there was a name, George Corwin. He was not just another official. He was born into a web of colonial power. His grandfather, John Winthrop the Younger, had governed Connecticut. His uncle, Judge Jonathan Corwin, sat on the panel that would later sentence accused witches to die. His father-in-law, Bartholomew Gedney, would soon join that same bench. And through these family ties, George Corwin, at only 25 years old, was appointed High Sheriff of Essex County. It was a position of immense power. The sheriff enforced arrests, delivered prisoners, confiscated property, and in Salem, the sheriff's seal could be a death sentence. Corwin's appointment was no accident. In a society built on family, religion, and fear, he was handed authority by blood. Salem was small. The Puritan elite ruled by reputation. And George Corwin had all the right names stitched into his life. But 1692 was not an ordinary year. Something darker crept in. That winter, strange behaviors were reported in the homes of prominent ministers. Young girls fell into fits, screamed without cause, claimed invisible hands pinched and struck them. The physician could not explain it. And in the absence of medicine, the town turned to the supernatural. Witches, they whispered. Witches among us. The first names to be accused were women. Poor. Outsiders. Unmarried. Bridget Bishop. Sarah Good. Tituba, the enslaved woman from Barbados. Warrants were issued, and George Corwin was the one to deliver them. He did not question the court. He did not pause at the stories. He obeyed, swiftly, quietly, and completely. He arrived with iron cuffs and a cold stare. He pulled women from homes, from beds, from prayer. He locked them in the stone jail on Prison Lane, their chains freezing against their skin. The people of Salem watched, some in fear, some in silence, some in awe. But the machinery was only just beginning. With every arrest, the hysteria grew stronger. And with every prisoner, George Corwin's power grew. He was no longer just the nephew of a judge. He was the face of enforcement. He was the one who came for you when your name was spoken. And now, a new name had been whispered. One that would test Corwin's silence. One that would make him more than a sheriff. Giles Corey, an old man, a landowner, a man who would not go quietly. Chapter 2, Warrants of Fear. The list was growing. Women, men, neighbors, ministers, merchants, and now Giles Corey. He was in his 80s, a farmer, strong despite his age, stubborn beyond measure. He had lived through wars, famines, and hard winters. But even Giles could not escape the reach of Salem's hysteria. His wife, Martha Corey, had already been arrested. She questioned the court, doubted the girls, called the accusations foolish. For that, she was marked. Soon after, so was her husband. In March of 1692, the arrest warrant for Giles Corey was signed. The ink had barely dried when George Corwin set out. Mounted on horseback, armed with legal authority and iron restraint, he made his way to the Corey farm. Witnesses say Giles did not resist. He stood with dignity, perhaps defiance. But the sheriff did not care for dignity. He followed the law, or what the court claimed was law. Giles was bound and brought to the Salem jail. Corwin, by now, had become routine in his work. The jails were overcrowded. Food was scarce. Conditions unbearable. But the town kept accusing, and Corwin kept arresting. Some of the accused were hanged. Others died in prison before their trials ever came. Still, the people of Salem continued to whisper. Children cried in fits. Livestock died mysteriously. Neighbors turned on each other with wild accusations. And the Puritan leaders fed the flames. They claimed the devil had made a home among them, that these witches were part of a grand conspiracy. Through it all, George Corwin moved in silence. He did not preach. He did not write. But he acted, without hesitation, without question. He oversaw the jailing of more than 100 people, signed dozens of arrest warrants, escorted condemned souls to the execution site on Proctor's Ledge. There, at the edge of town, he stood as the accused were hanged one by one. No trials of mercy, no final pleas, just the creak of rope and the silence that followed. But Giles Corey would change the rhythm. When brought before the court, Corey did something no one expected. He refused to enter a plea. Without a plea of guilty or not guilty, the court could not proceed. It was a form of protest, of resistance. Giles Corey would not give them the satisfaction. He would not legitimize the trials. It was a dangerous act. The court turned to a punishment few had seen in the New World, one borrowed from Old English law, a punishment designed to force a plea. It was called pain forte et dur, strong and hard pain. It involved no gallows, no rope, just stone, and wait, and silence. And George Corwin was ordered to carry it out. What happened next would stain Salem's soil forever. Chapter 3, The Weight of Giles Corey. September 1692. The air was brittle. The leaves had begun to curl. And in a small field near the jail, a wooden board was laid on the ground. Giles Corey was led there in chains. He was not screaming. He was not pleading. He was silent, still refusing to enter a plea, still defying the court that had taken his wife and now sought to take his land. The punishment was rare, unspoken in the colonies until now. Pain forte et dur, pressing a man with heavy stones until he either confessed or died. George Corwin supervised the procedure. First, Giles was stripped, his frail body, battered by age, exposed to the cold dirt. A wooden board was placed across his chest. Then came the stones, one by one, boulders, iron weights, slabs hauled from nearby construction. Each was laid with purpose. Each was laid with silence. Corwin watched. His hands did not tremble. He gave the order for more weight, and more weight came. Giles Corey's ribs began to bend inward. His breathing slowed. The bones cracked beneath the pressure. Still, he said nothing. At one point, his tongue bulged from his mouth. Witnesses say Corwin, ever composed, used the tip of his cane to push it back in. This was not justice. This was spectacle. And still Giles refused. For 2 days, he endured the pressing. Refused to speak. Refused to scream. Refused to give them what they wanted. The townspeople whispered. They came to watch, some in horror, some in grim fascination. By refusing to plead, Giles Corey had ensured that his land would not be seized by the state. It would pass to his heirs, not to the courts, not to the church, and not to George Corwin, who had taken so much already. On the third morning, as the sun rose through the autumn fog, Giles Corey uttered 3 final words. More weight. Then he died. His chest collapsed beneath the final stone. There was no triumph. No forgiveness. Only silence. And George Corwin? He walked away. He had carried out the punishment. Carried out the law. But something had changed. Something had shifted beneath the ground that day. The people of Salem began to question. Not just the court, but the men who enforced it. Giles Corey had died without fear. And now, the story was no longer just about witches. It was about power, and what men like George Corwin would do to keep it. Chapter 4, Loot and Law. Giles Corey was gone, but his silence echoed louder than any scream. In dying without a plea, he had blocked the court from legally seizing his land. And that defiance drew attention to a darker truth, what George Corwin had been doing with the possessions of the accused. As sheriff, Corwin had full authority to enforce arrests, transport prisoners, and oversee executions. But another duty fell under his jurisdiction, confiscation. Once someone was accused of witchcraft, Corwin did not wait for conviction. He arrived at homes with writs of seizure. Livestock was taken, furniture removed, gold, tools, books, and food vanished. Families who had not yet stood trial returned home to find everything gone. Some of it was sold. Some of it went missing, and all of it was justified under the veil of procedure. Among the most notable victims was Philip English, a wealthy merchant of French descent. English and his wife, Mary, were accused of witchcraft during the height of the hysteria. Their success, their land, their education, all made them targets. Envy and Salem wore the mask of morality. George Corwin acted swiftly. He seized their home. He took their possessions. He auctioned off livestock, silk, imported goods, even personal keepsakes before trial. Philip English, imprisoned and powerless, watched his estate vanish piece by piece. And he was not alone. Corwin's personal gain began to raise suspicion. Behind the fear of witches, behind the pious sermons, there was greed. Some whispered that the trials had become a tool, not for purging evil, but for acquiring wealth. And Corwin, with his family ties to judges and governors, faced no resistance. He became not just a symbol of law, but of exploitation. By the fall of 1692, the tide was beginning to turn. The execution of Giles Corey disturbed many. Ministers began to question the validity of spectral evidence, the kind that could not be seen or touched. Governor William Phipps, returning from war, halted the trials. Accusations slowed. Some prisoners were released. Others remained locked away, unsure if their names would ever be cleared. But George Corwin kept his title. He kept his authority. And he kept what he had taken. Philip English survived the ordeal. His wife did not. Years later, he sought justice, filed claims, demanded restitution. And the name George Corwin appeared not in a holy ledger, but in legal paperwork. The sheriff's hands were no longer clean. And in the quiet corners of Salem, people began to ask the question no one had dared before. What happens when the true criminal wears a badge? Chapter 5, The System Cracks. By the end of 1692, the storm was losing momentum. The Salem witch trials had claimed 19 lives by hanging, one by pressing. Dozens more languished in jail, cold, hungry, and forgotten. But outside the prison walls, the hysteria was weakening. Doubts were spreading. Ministers who once defended the court began to speak against it. Reverend Increase Mather, one of the most powerful voices in New England, condemned the use of spectral evidence. "It were better," he wrote, "that 10 suspected witches should escape than that one innocent person should be condemned." For Salem, it was too late. Governor William Phipps ordered the dissolution of the special court of Oyer and Terminer. The execution stopped. The jails slowly emptied. But no one apologized. No reparations were made. And Sheriff George Corwin remained untouched. He was still in office. Still in control. Still in possession of property taken from the accused. The townspeople whispered. The weight of silence grew heavier. The legal machine had paused, but its architects were still standing. Philip English returned to Salem. His wife Mary had died in prison. His home was gone. His wealth scattered. But he was not finished. He filed suit against the sheriff, demanding the return of stolen goods, demanding accountability. George Corwin responded with distance. The court system was reluctant to prosecute its own. The corruption was too close, too tangled. Judges were related to judges. Officials had married into one another's homes. Salem was a web. To pull one thread risked unraveling the whole cloth. So Corwin remained. He did not defend himself publicly. He did not write. He did not seek forgiveness. He simply continued. But the pressure was building. The town had changed. The smell of blood still lingered, even as snow began to fall. The gallows stood quiet, but not forgotten. The jail still echoed with stories. And the people remembered the names, Giles Corey, Bridget Bishop, Rebecca Nurse. They also remembered the man who chained them, pressed them, took their homes and watched them hang. They remembered George Corwin. And though no one dared arrest the sheriff, no one spoke his name without a shadow behind it. The law had cracked, but it had not yet broken. And before it could, something would take care of George Corwin. Something unexpected. Something sudden. Chapter 6, Heartstopper. April 12th, 1696. For years after the peak of the Salem witch trials, George Corwin was found dead. No warning, no illness, no slow decay, just a sudden and massive heart failure. He was 30 years old. The town went silent. There was no public mourning, no elaborate ceremony, no outpouring of sympathy. For many, Corwin's death felt like a closing chapter, sudden, brutal, and strangely poetic. The man who had overseen so many deaths died without explanation. But the silence didn't last long. Whispers returned to Salem. Some said it was justice. Some called it divine punishment. Others said it was something far older, a curse. The curse of Giles Corey. The old man crushed under stones had spoken no plea, only pain. But legend claimed he had spoken one last thing before death, a curse upon the Sheriff of Salem. There is no written record to prove this, no sworn testimony, but the legend lived on, grew larger, more detailed, and after Corwin's sudden death, it rooted itself in Salem's collective memory. Then the stories became stranger. Philip English, the merchant whose property Corwin had seized, made one final move. He refused to release Corwin's body for burial. He allegedly held the corpse hostage, demanding the return of stolen goods before allowing the sheriff to be laid to rest. It is said that for days, Corwin's body remained in limbo, above ground, unforgiven. Historical records do not confirm this ransom, but they do confirm a legal dispute between English and Corwin's estate, and they do confirm fear, because Corwin's death had sent a chill deeper than any rope. It wasn't just that he died young. It was how. Instant. Without time to confess. Or repent. Or even prepare. The same way so many had died under his hand. The people remembered. And now, something else began to take root. A pattern. Decades passed. New sheriffs were appointed in Essex County. And strange things kept happening. Sharp chest pains. Sudden illnesses. Resignations without cause. A few claimed they felt uneasy working in the sheriff's office. Then located near Washington Street, where George Corwin had once lived. One by one, they left, until in 1991, the sheriff's department moved out of Salem entirely. Some say the curse finally lifted. Others say it simply followed. But one thing remained buried beneath all the records and robes, the memory of a man who enforced law like a weapon, and died like he lived, without warning. Chapter 7, Haunted Foundations. George Corwin was gone, but something stayed behind. His home, once standing at 148 Washington Street, did not crumble with his death. Instead, it changed hands, passed through generations, rebuilt, renovated, and eventually, it became what is now known as the Joshua Ward House. Today, it's a boutique hotel. Elegant, quiet, welcoming. But beneath the paint, beneath the bricks, beneath the polished charm, is a foundation soaked in history. A history that refuses to rest. Over the years, guests and staff at the Joshua Ward House have reported chilling phenomena. Sudden cold drafts in locked rooms. Shadow figures passing by mirrors. Doors slamming without wind. Lights flickering in patterns that make no electrical sense. But the most famous claim is the Lady in Black. She appears in photographs. She's been seen descending the staircase. Always dressed in black, her face distorted, blurred, or burning in the image. Paranormal investigators say she may be the spirit of a woman executed under Corwin's orders. Others believe she is not a victim, but George Corwin himself, returning as something twisted. One photograph, taken in the 1980s, became infamous. A realtor, standing alone, snapped a picture inside the house. When developed, the photo showed a burnt-looking woman standing behind him. Her features melted, her eyes vacant, her mouth twisted into something between grief and rage. There was no one there when the photo was taken. Reports only escalated after that. Guests have woken to pressure on their chests, to whispers in the dark. Some refused to stay more than a single night. The basement, where Corwin allegedly held prisoners during the witch trials, is said to be the most active location. Cold spots linger. Candles blow out. Some have claimed they feel breath on their necks when no one is nearby. Tour guides now include the Joshua Ward House on lists of the most haunted places in Salem. It draws tourists, paranormal seekers, ghost hunters. But for others, especially locals, it is a place of quiet dread. Because history in Salem is not sealed in textbooks. It lives in the ground. It clings to old beams and stone cellars. And in the case of George Corwin, it may have never left at all. The same man who crushed lives in the name of justice may still be watching the doors he once opened. Waiting. Remembering. Chapter 8, The Curse of the Enforcer. George Corwin left no confession, no apology, no public reckoning. History moved on. The trials ended, the gallows rotted, the jails emptied, and still, no official blame was placed at his feet. No court ever tried him, no record condemned him. But Salem remembered. To this day, when people speak of the witch trials, they name the accused, they name the judges. But beneath it all, quietly and chillingly, lies the memory of the sheriff. The one who did not need to believe in witches, only in obedience. Corwin was more than a footnote. He was the mechanism, the iron hands that turned orders into suffering, that made suspicion into punishment. He escorted the condemned to their deaths. He chained the wrists of grieving mothers. He pressed the chest of an old man until it broke. He confiscated homes, sold lives in pieces. And when it was over, he simply carried on, until something stopped him. Maybe it was justice. Maybe it was guilt. Maybe it was nothing at all. But the mystery of his death, fast and unceremonious, became something larger. A legacy. A curse. Some believe Giles Corey truly cursed him. Some believe Corwin cursed himself. What is certain is that the fear he helped create never truly left Salem. It simply changed form. From nooses and trials to hauntings and legends. He is buried now in Broad Street Cemetery. A name carved in stone. Surrounded by others long forgotten. But his shadow stretches far beyond that grave. It reaches into ghost tours, into legal records, into the whispers of sheriffs who came after. For nearly 300 years, his name has lived in the spaces where justice and cruelty blur, in the weight of decisions made under pressure, in the silence of men who follow orders, without question. Sheriff George Corwin never stood trial, but history did not let him go, because in the story of Salem, where fear was turned into law and the law into a weapon, one man held the badge that made it real. And long after the witches were buried, the sheriff remained.